Hello and welcome to A History of Christian Theology. My name's Chad Kim. This week, I will be talking with Dr. Drew Johnson about his book, What Hath Darwin to Do with Scripture? Comparing Conceptual Worlds of the Bible and Evolution with InterVarsity Press. And we are grateful to InterVarsity Press for providing a copy of this book, not only to me, but also to my guest co-host, Grant Belchamber. So Grant works with me behind the scenes, a student at St. Louis University. Often he edits and does social media and stuff for the podcast, but in this episode, he gets to get in on the action of interviewing one of the authors. So this was great fun for me and for Grant. So I'm thankful for Drew for talking with us, a new host, a new interviewer, and myself. And I think you'll really enjoy this conversation. It's a pretty different way of thinking about the overlap between the scriptures and scientific teaching. It's not directly about the creation evolution debates, but more about the broader overlaps between sort of scientific investigation and how that relates to the, especially the Hebrew Bible, but the New Testament as well. So grateful to Dr. Johnson for coming on and for Grant and all of his work. If you would please rate us and review us on iTunes. It helps other people find the podcast. Also, we have a lot going on our Patreon. We'll be continuing to upload new episodes there. So that'll be slightly different content, not author interviews, but some teaching that I've done at my church, as well as conversations with Tom and Trevor and just a few different things like that. We're getting a very lively community there. So please do join on Patreon. We really appreciate your support. Helps keep the podcast going. So thank you as well to all of our supporters. All right. Well, we have a few more episodes coming up. Lots of interviews lined up. We'll talk about things like how to deal with distraction, how monks deal with distraction. We've got other interviews on the lineup about Augustine and demons and angelology. So lots of different stuff coming forward in the podcast. So thanks for listening. Rate us, review us on iTunes, and do check out our Patreon, patreon.com/ahoct, A-H-O-C-T. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Drew Johnson and Grant Belchamber. Yeah, well, we are very fortunate and excited to have Dr. Drew Johnson on the History of Christian Theology. Although today it will not just be me and a guest, it will be Chad Kim, Grant Belchamber, and Dr. Drew Johnson. So I've actually spoken with Dr. Johnson, with Drew on here before on his book, Biblical Philosophy with Cambridge Press. And then Grant, I've mentioned Grant before in an intro here and there, but he started as a student of mine in a Latin class, I think, is when I first met Grant. And so he's kind of been helping behind the scenes, but we've been wanting to get him onto an episode. And he was really interested in the title, the description, the blurbs from Drew's book. So we got Ivy Press to send us two copies. So we're thankful to Krista Clayton and the marketing team at Ivy Press for being willing to give us two copies so that Grant could be on here. So welcome, Grant.
I'm very excited to be joining you.
Awesome. So let's get started. So the book that we're here to talk about is What Hath Darwin to Do with Scripture? Comparing the Conceptual Worlds of the Bible and Evolution. And so, as I said, part of the reason that we wanted to have Drew on here was it was an intriguing thesis for both of us. We don't do as much on the Old Testament and really not much on evolution, although I did talk to Danny Houck, who talks a little bit about original sin, although we never got to the sort of his evolutionary sort of the last chapter or two of that book. We didn't really talk much about that. But other than that, I've not really had a whole lot of time to sort of delve into evolution and more scientific kind of intersections with theology and biblical studies. So this should be some new territory for our audience. So I thought maybe we could just start. Drew, what are you trying to do with this book? Like a sort of basic thesis.
You know, actually there's a guy who does book reviews on YouTube, Joel Wentz.
Okay.
He just put out a book review where his explanation is it's better than mine. When people ask me this question, yeah, I'm now going to just plagiarize him.
All right.
Or citing him. But, there are many books, and articles and videos on The historicity of creation or not? Can you swap in evolution and just say at some point the image of God is deigned onto humans and God uses those techniques or that technique to sculpt humanity? There's more what I consider the data-driven science side arguments about what best explains the data. And so this book is not that. This book is not trying to explain the data. It's actually, and this is why I went with IVP, because John Boyd, the editor, immediately picked up what I wanted people to see in this book, which was this is really just a continuation of that Cambridge book, comparing the conceptual world of Darwin and later evolutionary science or current evolutionary science with the same topics of natural selection covered by the biblical authors, and saying, hey, the biblical authors actually talk about the exact same thing Darwin's concerned about. And I don't mean that in some kind of like you have to strain your eyes to see it. I mean, once you see it, it becomes really obvious. Mm-hmm. The issue of scarcity that begets violence and competition, the intertwining of that topic with fit to environment, and then also the concern for sexual propagation. I mean, that is Genesis 1 through 11, kind of even at a superficial reading. and certainly the rest of Genesis and the Torah, and I try to show it continues into the New Testament as well. So really getting at what are the philosophical underpinnings and the biblical author's view of what they don't call natural selection, but essentially their discussion of what we might call natural selection, what their view of natural means, how selection works for them, and then just putting that in conversation with Darwin's view of natural selection and then later evolutionary science, which are not identical. They develops and gets debated, still debated to this day, at least exactly what constitutes selection mechanisms. And then seeing where there's overlap between those two conceptual worlds and seeing where the sticking points are. It comes from years of me just feeling like the conversation was ignoring the biblical view on these things and just trying to get that side going again. So it really is what John Boyd, he calls it a disruptive book. It's meant to be a conversation starter. Yeah. Not certainly, it's too short to be a conversation ender, but it's a conversation starter. Yeah.
I think that, well, even that idea comes across right at the conclusion. You say, I sort of offer this out there for people to come, you know, test, to question, to struggle with. Just your introduction there, and we were briefly talking beforehand about your sort of love for data-driven interpretation, or not maybe not interpretation, but writing and study. And it reminded me, I listened to another podcast sometimes called Econ Talk with Russ Roberts, and he was just talking to another economist about how he feels like economics has become so focused on the data that no one is doing interesting theoretical work. And in a weird way, that reminded me of your book, because when you talk about evolution here, and this may get into our next question, you're not, you know, the title is What Hath Darwin to Do with Scripture, but you really are talking about other theories, other ways that sort of broadly evolutionary science has sort of tried to come to terms with some stuff that may have begun with Darwin, but has moved forward. But the point of the connection to Russ Roberts was he was saying that nobody wants to do the sort of really fascinating theoretical work anymore. Like that's sort of left the scene in his mind in economics. And I was just thinking, like, but that's part of what makes your book fun, is because you are doing that theory behind some of the work on evolution, but also in your own way, the theory behind what does it mean to be a reader of the Old Testament? What is the theoretical world that they are creating for us? And so it helps us kind of say, how can we read Scripture differently? Or as you like to say, how can you have Scripture reason with us differently? Right.
Yeah, that's my super secret squad goal, is to actually get people to just be better readers of Scripture, and using just a really spicy case study to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. So listeners know, like, one of the things that you're trying to do is help us read Scripture better, and you have this kind of argument where you're looking at some themes that are already in Scripture, which Darwin begins and evolutionary theorists use, but you also are trying to be clear about stuff that you're not saying. So what could you, you know, I know that that's an important part, to not misread you on that. So can you maybe lay out a few of those for us?
Yeah, you know, at the very last minute before I submitted the final manuscript, they asked me to cut 25,000 words. So I, I don't remember what's in the book and what I cut out.
Okay.
But it was a smart cut. If you enjoyed the read at all, that's because of the cutting. But I am certainly, I'm not trying to settle the question as to whether there's a historical Adam and Eve. I'm not trying to settle the question as to how evolutionary theories and the Garden of Eden or Genesis 1 through 11 can be reconciled, at least without remainder. I'm not really trying to get into the fray of bottlenecks in genetics or anything like that. And I think Josh Schwaminas has a really interesting, actually also from St. Louis, yeah, at WashU there, has some really interesting ideas on that. And he comes from computational biology, so I trust he knows what he's talking about there. But I'm really trying to move the reader into a different stance with the biblical text, and kind of a similar stance that they have probably with evolutionary science in general, is they hear it postulating and theorizing and providing some perspectives on why they think it's this way. And we just go, oh, okay. You know, we can watch a Nova special or whatever and go, oh, okay. I don't know what to, I hear what they're saying. I don't know what to think about all that. Well, I think the biblical authors are doing something very similar by the way they talk about these features of early humanity. And I'm just not trying to, I tried with all my might to make sure that publishers did not categorize this as a creationist book. It did get categorized that way by Amazon, I think.
Yeah.
But I was trying like the Dickens to keep it out of that world. Because I just didn't want all the emails from people right, telling me why I'm going to burn in hell for whatever they didn't read in my book. But B, it really doesn't belong to that conversation. This is like, as we would say, it's prolegomenal to that conversation. So that's where I think my mind works the clearest, is getting to the first issues before we start talking about how to think about the data. Because as we know, all data are theory laden. Mm-hmm. So thinking about the theories that the biblical authors spin and how the scientific community, again, there's some significant overlap, but I also think there are some more profound conflicts than you would find just in the normal creation evolution debates as well.
Yeah. Well, one of the kind of interesting sections for me, like I said, I sent you some questions beforehand, but one of them was you help us try to redefine nature a little bit, and also, well, and metaphysics. I kept, when you would use the word metaphysics, I kept going, okay, wait a minute. It's not what I normally think of when I think of metaphysics. No. But a similar thing that you do with nature, and then the fact that you mention nature reminded me that Mark Garcia, a guy I work with at Greystone Institute in Westminster Seminary, he sort of recommended to me a book called Before Nature by Francesca Rochberg. Yeah. And it's a really interesting thesis. I haven't made my way through the whole book, but the idea
I'm in a work group with Francesca.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Ancient Near Eastern, Intellectual World of Ancient Near East work group, the German group that I was talking about. Yeah. Francesca's in that group. I'm a super fan of Francesca. So,
okay. Well, then at least part of it then explains one thing, I had never, like when Mark introduced me to kind of the thesis and then I began to look at her book, I was like, what would a world be like if you couldn't use the word nature? And I felt like there was something you were trying to do that's akin to that, although you're more amenable to actually using the word nature, because I think you sort of have to, because this is a little bit different level work than what she's doing. But yeah, I don't know. Respond to that. Help us think through what you mean by nature and why that's such a hard concept to almost get rid of, at least in her view.
I've had some friends of mine, some Israeli friends of mine who actually that work kind of on the Hebrew Bible and philosophy realm that have also said, I mean, one of my friends is a Plato scholar and he said, hey, as soon as you're saying nature, you're already in the Greek world. Like you're already tacitly accepting the Greek categories. I was like, that's a really good point. But in this kind of a book, where I'm trying to talk to lots of different audiences, you can only create so much disruption and duress in a reader before they quit reading. So I just went ahead and went for it. the question is, what is natural? And I'm glad you said that about metaphysics, because Richard Middleton has also said, like, I don't like this term metaphysics. I was like, I don't like it either. I just don't know what else to call it. So if you have another term, I'm like, I'm fully game, or another analogy or metaphor, the orientation metaphor. But essentially it's, you know, in the creation story, and I should say the creation stories, because there's references to creation throughout scripture, right? We think of just Genesis 1, 2, and 3, but there are actually lots of references that are alluded to and full-on investigations of, like I would say Deuteronomy 28 is a kind of an excavation of Genesis 1 through 3 and the metaphysics of 1 through 3. But what we're asking is, how was the world oriented before anything went wrong, mm-hmm. right? In the same way that I might say, yeah, the tabernacle is great. It's a way of God accommodating humans, but the tabernacle and the temple are not the way it's supposed to be, according to the story of the Hebrew Bible. It's mm-hmm. an accommodation. It's a compromise document, mm-hmm. the tabernacle is, right? And so what was that world like, or what kind of picture do they paint of this world? And again, it's not entirely cemented in Genesis 1 through 3. It's the first 5 minutes of the movie, maybe the first 1 minute of the movie. And so it's really from the further iterations of that story and the retelling of Eden through various characters and situations and the rest of the Torah, and then on in the Hebrew history of the Hebrew Bible, where you get a clarification of what they think is going on. And the best word I can use is there's a proper orientation and before anything goes wrong. My Jewish friends are very sensitive to the Christian idea of the fall. they would call it the stumble or the slip or something like that, but that's fine. You can just say before anything went wrong, or before anything went notably wrong that it was written about, because you still have the serpent to deal with in the background story that you don't know where that comes from. Things seem to be oriented towards beneficence, towards animals and humans, and like that fittedness issue, that things seem to be fitted well together. And I try to explore how even the language used of the man is noting constantly the fittedness of the creature to the environment mm-hmm. in deeper ways than just it's comfortable here. And then the exile east of Eden comes with the turning of creation against humans mm-hmm. in some way. And it seems like Genesis 3 through 9 has some idea of super scarcity going on, just destitute poverty and scarcity, because there's no calories to be eked out of the landscape or something like that seems to be in mind there, with some relief, but not total relief after Genesis 9. I'm honestly interested. I mean, it's in the book. It's already printed. I can't change the word metaphysical, but I also am dissatisfied with that view. But I just point out, when it comes to the word nature, that's what the biblical, if you were to pull the biblical author into the present, explain all of this and say, this is our view of nature, he'd say, no, nature is when things were the way they were supposed to be. That's natural. Mm. Everything mm-hmm. after that is unnatural in mm-hmm. some sense. And Josh Swamidas, who actually helped me, he corrected an earlier manuscript and kept me from creating egregious mistakes with my language about science. He just said, like, nobody understands nature that way. Like, you can't, because I was using nature in the kind of the biblical author's perspective way. And he's like, that's too problematic. You just got to quit doing that. So you notice I have like scare quotes around, or so-called nature is what I have to use throughout the book to identify this new version of nature. And nature also has God's causal actions built into it. So mm-hmm. God is not cut outside of nature. He's part and parcel of nature. And you can talk about primary and secondary causes of God, but those are all natural. Mm-hmm. And so we can talk about bending nature in certain ways and signs and wonders, or doing things or using nature in unusual and surprising ways and signs and wonders, but signs and wonders aren't unnatural, mm-hmm. right? In that sense. And so I use the Gloria Patri as the kind of the moniker for thinking about this. I know some people probably will not be happy about that, but the biblical authors, you know, if evolutionary scientists, and rightfully so, I don't fault them for this at all, but if you were to say, they might say something like, as the cosmos was in the beginning, it still is and will evermore be, right? You know, the laws of thermodynamics are not changing. Constants of physics are not changing. And the biblical authors would actually say, no, as it was in the beginning, is currently not that way right now, but will one day be restored too, right? That we actually live in a metaphysically different time than it will be in the future. And that kind of guides their thinking about everything that's happening right now. And I'm trying to avoid the word nature, but it's the nature of our relationship to creation itself is embedded in that that metaphysical problem of that creation does not work solely towards our beneficence, and we don't perfectly fit it, and there are ways in which we fit it even worse, in which the world itself can, or the land itself can cast us off and kick us out because we don't fit it anymore.
Yeah. Well, there's so many things that like they're pinging in my brain as you were speaking.
I can imagine.
and one of them is I'd never heard Dale Martin. I took a class with him in my doctoral program, and he talked a lot about the distinction that he wanted to make between nature and supernature. And so he sort of helped us work through this whole argument that there wasn't an idea of supernature until he claims pseudo-Dionysus. But be that as it may, you know, and that may be another way to crack this nut a little bit, is because whatever biblical authors thought of as nature, they didn't think of God as outside of it, and sort of, you know, only working in on it at specific points. And that's one way of thinking in my mind about how to get closer to a conception of the biblical world, is you can't sort of say that God only works outside of, that God is only outside of it and only kind of in really specific cases, kind of like specifically poking in or something. I don't really, I was trying to get a better metaphor, but.
Well, and I don't know what to tell people who are hung up on aseity and simplicity and, you know, God outside of time and mixed relations between God and space and time. And the goal of the book is not to correspond biblical thinking to modern systematic categories, is to correspond it to scientific categories, right? So for better or for worse, so we can only do so much.
Well, and the other thing that was pinging in my brain, though, and I know that you are no big fan of Augustine, but a lot of the things that you say are ways in which when I work through the Confessions, I actually see Augustine saying this, right? So he uses the Latin, the language of God making, facere, humans deficere, humans like destroying, and then Christ coming reficere to return to what had been made. And so there's sort of that's one framing device that he uses, especially in the latter half of the Confessions, which fewer people read, is sort of his working through Genesis. And I know that you would hate the way that he works through Genesis, but
it's fine. Like, he can read Hebrew. It's not his fault. We can't blame him. And he offers so much good to the world. We don't want to say how, you know, I don't want to slam him for weaknesses he can't be held accountable for. So.
but it's funny because as much as he was committed to aseity and some of the things that you were just talking about, you know, it's like he's always willing to like at least negotiate it a little bit with what he's reading in scripture. Yeah. And so you can always see, you can feel him kind of go, this is the best language I have for this. Yep. This is what scripture says. I've got a kind of, you know, God is still jealous, even though I don't know how God is jealous, given what I know God to be. He also delights in a pair. Yeah.
Yeah. He's negotiating. And I think I feel like we all are, right? All theology is contextual, even Augustine. So
yeah. He's just the super context that we all have to respond to.
Yeah, exactly. He is the super. That's a good way of putting it too. Yeah, I got an Augustinian down the road from me here. So
Grant, is there any questions that you have right away or anything that you wanted to jump in before we kind of switch gears?
Yeah, actually I had another like definition of terms type question. Because you talk about the conceptual worlds quite a bit. And that notion, I guess it makes sense on the surface, but I feel like it would be helpful for you to talk a little bit about what that notion entails. Because I feel like the argument of the book is very dependent upon that.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a laziness on my part where I was just kind of appealing to a colloquial notion. It's funny, I was waiting for somebody to ask me about that. So you're the first. But yeah, I think conceptual worlds is what metaphors, what styles of analogical reasoning. I mean, if you've spent any time in different cultural contexts, you realize instantly that people like employ different analogical reasoning to talk about very similar topics. So what's the suite of analogies and embodied reasoning that gets pulled upon by them? How do they reason about the nature of second order issues is something I developed in that Cambridge book. Like, how do they actually talk about things outside of concrete, you know, the idea of a thing outside of a concrete instance of a thing. And so the conceptual world for me is constructed through, and this would be true today as well. I would even say this of analytic philosophers, their conceptual world for me is constructed through the stories they tell about what they think they're doing. In as much as the actual concepts, metaphors, analogies, that they return to over and over again. And it's the literary devices that clue us in. So, be most simple, you know, as I'm reading through scripture with students, you know, I always say like, wow, they repeated that three times in one passage. What do you think that means? You know? And I mean, there's something as simple as repetition, but also lots of other, literary devices because they don't have punctuation, or paragraph markers or paratextual, ability to indicate how to chunk their literature. They use something actually that's more sophisticated than telling, which is literary device, in order to show you what they think is most important about that story you just read, probably knowing that you're freaking out about the story they just read. So I always use the story of the Akedah with the binding of Isaac. You know, I think most of us read that story at least the first time, and all we think is like, what kind of a God is asking a man to kill his son, right? His only son whom he loves. And of course, the Gospels are going to answer that question using the same language, using literary device, in order to help you understand that they're metalepsisizing, I don't know what the verb would be, using metalepsis to bring that story forward into the story of Jesus. But in that story, like if you follow, if it's a narrative, and if you follow the, it's a very stratified, repetitious story, and if you follow the stratum of narrative and the repetition, it simply is not interested in answering the question, what kind of a God would ask a man to kill his son? It's like, it's just uninterested entirely, right? Now, I think they're assuming they're going to tell you what kind of a God over time and circumstance in the rest of the biblical literature. But that's how the biblical author, so that's how the biblical authors are doing this work of revealing what their conceptual world is like. And by that, I don't mean they're telling you about what kind of a God would ask a man to kill himself. They're actually telling you how we're going to tell the story. They're kind of giving you the shape of their conceptual spheres and how they conceptualize topics. And I mean, I hate to say it, but the best way to get at their conceptual world is to spend lots of time in the text and take literary structure seriously. And you know, Robert Alter has done a lot, and Mayer, Mayer Malul as well in a different way, but Mayer Sternberg, sorry, Adela Berlin, right? There's people who have really helped us focus again on literary technique and why honoring literary technique is honoring the conceptual world of the author. So I'm not like just saying like, oh, I have this fuzzy feeling that they're after this. I think there are methodological constraints that could help you point to data, as it were, where I can say like, no, I can show you why I think this is in their conceptual world, or and we can argue about data-driven ideas rather than just merely, here's my intuitions on this.
Okay. And would you say that you see that same type of literary device or conceptual arrangement in Darwinistic thinking to compare the two conceptual worlds?
Well, you're full of interesting questions. Okay. So, and by interesting, I always mean hard, right? That's a hard one to answer. Yeah, I think in Origin of Species... Well, I could say something very basic to answer that question, which is you read Origin of Species, and I don't know what the organizing principle there is, but it's clearly something like, you know, something akin to the Ramist logic that organizes the Westminster Confession. It's, you know, it's like a very particular logical formulation that gets you to certain questions, then answering certain questions. It feels very treatise-like to me. It wouldn't surprise me if Darwin had been reading lots of treatises in Cambridge in his day, and he's mimicking that style. But again, he's mimicking a literary style to kind of excavate his findings and his ideas over the course of the literature. And he doesn't give it to you all in once. I mean, you really have to read on and on and on to kind of figure out how he thinks about things and what he thinks are the most important pieces of data and what are subordinated to those. So yeah, which I found fascinating. One of the things I really enjoyed most about this project was reading Darwin again. And I'm sure some people will say I didn't read him well enough, but just really being in awe of his intellect and how well my original title for the book was What Darwin and Scripture Noticed. And part of that was that I think the biblical authors would be like, no, you've done well, Dharma. You actually have paid close attention to the nature of nature, like what is going on with nature right now. And you have really, you've seen real things, that count. And I think his explanations are onto things. So I don't, that's a separate question from whether evolutionary ideas, descent of man, like whether those are true or not, testable, feasible, et cetera, separate question. But he certainly has an organizing literary encyclopedia that he's working from. So
we're going to have Drew Martin come on and talk a little bit about 18th century and 17th century England and the origins of the Westminster Confessions, mostly mostly because he's a good friend of mine and his book just came out. So, I was just thinking, you know, part of the thing that he talks about is just how the kind of writing that was so prevalent in the time. And so you could sort of see why that could be, you know, shape the world of Darwin. And that's not the point of it. His book is totally unrelated to that. But just as a side note, things that feel sort of specific to the Westminster Confession or something like that are actually just they're everywhere. And so it.
I was just thinking about this the other day. Like, I don't know if you've read many titles of books from the 18th century, but they're like three sentences long on the nature of Elizabethan English as spoken by women on the street in London. I mean, it's just. It's remarkable how different our ideas of evidence and conglomerating evidence through particular literary devices, how we consider certain things convincing now that we would never have before, and vice versa. So, anyways, yes,
nice. Well, one question that I like to ask to just sort of be a sort of get to know the author a little bit, perhaps, and your way of thinking is, I like to say, ask, what is one thing that you once thought was true and now think is false, or one thing that you think is false, but you now think is true? You're a very, as you've said, a more data-driven person, so you're very willing to be convinced by new evidence. So I suspect this will be less difficult for you, but I like it just as a question to get to know what causes people to change their minds about things. And I always say it can relate to the book if you like. So your research for the book, or it could just be something totally different in your life that you know, that was sort of interesting. You were once a Cardinals fan. Although
never a Cardinals fan.
Yeah. I guess you're not from St. Louis. You just lived here.
I lived there 18 years, which is long enough to realize why I'm not a Cardinals fan. So, I also like to say, if you want to stop a conversation in a St. Louis dinner party, when asked, where did you go to high school? Just tell them that you're a dropout from Oklahoma. And that just, like, you can hear the record scratch. Certainly there are a lot of things that I would change my, one of them, I'm trying to think if this is what I said last time I was on your podcast. It might be it, but it is one that jumps immediately to mind is, through my work on ritual, when just studying ritual theory and thinking more, I'd always thought a lot about the body and how the body informs theology and all that stuff, but really getting neck deep in ritual theory, it's one of those duh moments where I think I used to think entirely of lecture and class as content modeling. Mm-hmm. So in almost a shame-based model, like what would I be embarrassed of if somebody who took my class met one of my colleagues a year or two later and they said, oh, did you talk about X, Y, or Z? And they're like, no, we never talked about that at all. And that, I'm not lying, that determined a lot of things that I kept in my class, right? Which now I think is silly in some ways. I mean, there's due diligence, but it was silly. The work on ritual shifted me over to what kinds of things am I going to ask my students to embody in order to dispose them to see the world the way I need them to see it, so they can hear what I'm trying to tell them, right? Or maybe so they can hear what I'm trying to tell them so they can see what I'm trying to show them. Whatever metaphor works better there. I think my syllabus time is a lot of like, what shape am I asking them to put their body? Is it sitting? Is it reading? Is it in front of their, you know, phone? How are they going to interact with this? Is it through their phone, their laptop? Class time. I just don't talk technically in class anymore. I talk much more casually because what I'm trying to get them to see is more important than them showing them that I have a large vocabulary and I know exactly what I'm talking about, which is funny because it does humiliate you as well, because you get to the end of the semester and I'll no lie, the number of times per the semester where a student comes to my office, they see my Hebrew Bible open, they go, "You can read Hebrew?" I'm like, yeah, I sure can. Kind of have to in my profession. So kind of giving up on that, like the formal models of content delivery and thinking much more about their bodies and what will actually work is a huge paradigm shift in my mind. I don't know if that counts as false or not, but false and now true, yeah. But it was a massive paradigm shift for me.
Yeah. I like it. Yeah, I do. I've been modifying some my teaching styles as well. Just I did hear a podcast recently where someone was saying that most of our students can't recall precisely, like they can recall very little, like 10 years down the road. But what they remember tend to be stories, and sort of like and then he goes, I can't remember, a PhD from Harvard, teaches at Columbia or vice versa, but he's like, I have no other word than vibes. and he was like, students seem to remember a vibe.
I'm telling you, I have used the word vibe more. My mom had Alzheimer's too, and what really stuck with me was she couldn't remember anything that happened, you know, but towards the end, more than 2 or 3 minutes ago, she absolutely could remember how she felt an hour ago. Like if you made her mad or made her joyful or whatever, the feeling stuck, the content did not. So, yeah.
Grant, did you have one of your other questions that you wanted to jump in with?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a bit of a tone shift, but I have one more.
Vibe shift.
Okay, so you talk briefly about violence and its link to scarcity in the book, and you tell the story of the hummingbird feeder, which I don't remember well enough to entirely recap. But my question is, what kind of account of sin, if any, do you think could be drawn from whether it's scarcity specifically or the evolutionary principles in general? And the if any is kind of, I'm emphasizing that there because I don't know if there will be one.
Yeah. Well, I don't know fully what account works. I think what has, and this began in seminary where sin wasn't reduced to things I do wrongly or things I do wrong. But it actually was a more holistic vision that was given to me in seminary, which I'm very grateful for. And quite honestly, you know, I came into seminary as a combat veteran, so I wasn't going to tolerate any kind of flimsy, you know, sin is something that happens by your will defecting in your soul or something like that. That was not, I would have walked out if they tried to pull that one on me. But so I think what I appreciate about evolutionary perspectives, well, I mean, just quite honestly, like the scientific perspective in general, is they don't shy away from the way the world actually is, right? Even in my epistemology, my views of knowledge, Chad knows this, that, you know, there's kind of romantic fantasy versions of how we know things. And then there's a whole group of epistemology people who are just like, let's just ask psychologists how people actually know things, you know, like let's give up on the fantasy and talk about how it actually happens. And so I think when you talk about evolutionary psychologists and biologists are fully primed to understand an account of sin from scripture that goes down to the dirt itself, that goes down into the relation of the dirt to the trees to the birds to the humans, in a way in which I don't think your average Christian going to church, you know, if they're not paying that much attention, just kind of going to church, casually reading their Bible, I don't think they are as primed as an evolutionary biologist is for the full biblical account of sin. And I know that is true because I've, you know, kind of had this conversation with scientists and they can go like, oh, and then they'll immediately give you an example from creation that they've studied discreetly and are an expert in which that seems to be true. And they can see that is true in their own way. So, and what I'm interested in, and you caught this at the end of the book, is the reverse is, ought there to be physical indications that all of that can be reoriented rightly as well. And that's where I talked about life extension and psychedelics, which which the publisher was like, we're going to need you to spell out exactly what you're going to say about psychedelics. So that was why that big italicized, this is not an endorsement. As somebody who did psychedelics back in the 80s, that was not an endorsement of psychedelics. So I think, you know, again, that account of sin that you get in scripture that really is full orbed and includes all of creation, not just the souls of people, but can account for why an animal must be executed if it murders a human, right? Like everybody's got a theory until they run into like Jonah, where the cows are in sackcloth and ash and repenting, or where animals have to be killed because they murdered a human, right? And that's where like the rubber hits the road. So yeah, I think that full orbed all of creation account of sin is really, you know, is already baked into this conversation. And in fact, I think what you find is a lot of scientists who are largely theist of some sort. Most of them are, you know, just by the surveys, most American scientists have some belief in a God or a higher power. I think they are, you know, they are struggling. When the chapters on sex, which I'm sure you're going to ask me about at some point here, how can you go without the sex talk? You know, you can just see like everybody is very clinical until you get to the issue of sex. And then all of a sudden the arguments get very heated and, because the implications are just so ripe for people who have experienced those things today, right? Did I answer your question or did I just like skate around it?
You did answer it. It went in a different direction than I thought you would take it, but it was an answer to it. So
okay. That is a perfect response. It was an answer to my question. As the philosophers say, you're not wrong.
Well, I like your discussion of, I mean, I hadn't have thought it so much about the scientist, how you framed it there, but you know, sin is something inside you versus the scientist seeing it in all the stuff that they study, and then use the example of why the animal had sackcloth on. It also reminds me of I was teaching a class. And this was just an offhand comment. And I was like, well, you know, God makes a covenant with the animals in the Noah story. And like, you could have heard a pin drop in the room.
You see people's brains breaking at that moment.
And I was like, I mean, yeah, they do. And then I fortunately I had some people who are like me who love animals or love to be involved in the dirt and in the world and things like that. And it was like, oh yeah, I forgot that this is a lot bigger of a story than just how I the defection of the will or something, you know, some other very sterile and really esoteric kind of definition.
I just like to say untestable.
Yeah. Well, or untestable. And I'm one who can enjoy some untestable debate.
No, I think we have to have a dialectic between the untestable and the testable. Absolutely.
But it also reminded me of a question I was thinking about. Like, sometimes I feel like what you're pushing back against is it, like, I'm like, is it sort of an ancient Hellenistic, in your other book, it was like, you know, how much is Hellenistic philosophy going in the, but in this book, I felt like almost more, it was a pushback against the modern world, and sort of like a post-industrial kind of Zoom world. In some ways, what the evolutionary theorists and the biblical, or like Darwin maybe, and the biblical world are, you know, saying like, no, there's something about reality that you can't escape. Mm-hmm. And if you are only ever in your room, you know, sort of, you know, typing on Twitter, and what do the kids say? You don't ever touch grass.
That's a slam, right?
Yeah.
My daughter taught me that, to turn around and go touch grass to someone. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and as listeners will know, I've been really getting into, like, we have 12 chickens. We grow a lot of our own food. And there are just things that you learn from, like, chickens don't always just lay eggs.
No, they have a cycle. Why not?
They have a cycle. And you can't – I mean, you can try to affect it and change it some, but there's literally a physical limit.
And then they're just –
What's that?
And then they're just meat.
Yeah, and then they're just meat. Well, and yeah. Other aspects of having chickens is like the first time we had a rooster, and you can't have one in the city. I was like, well, I'll drive it out somewhere and give it to someone and make sure that he's happy and healthy. And then eventually you realize, but yeah, this is where stew comes from. Right. You can't have too many roosters, and so you have to stew the meat because it's not as good. Yeah. And there's a physical limitation. Now we're moving farther on from sin, but I think it's also, when you talk about fit, where fittingness comes in, fittingness implies that you're not the one who gets to determine the fittingness. Right. It is a principle or a force or something beyond you, reality that shapes you. You don't shape it. That is a hard thing for, I mean, even for me, I'm a suburban kid. All this stuff is new to me. That's why it's so fascinating. I'm sure if I'd grown up on a farm like my grandpa, he'd be like, "You're crazy, kid." But
well, my grandfather was a farmer in Wentzville, Missouri as well. So, I mean, that the chapter where I go through the Negev, I don't know if you read that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was interesting to me. I'm not sure how it was interesting to everybody else, but I was like, I got to include this. This is too fun for me. But that difference between, and of course, living in Israel for a while, the Bedouin encounter, because it's anachronistic, but you look at Bedouin camps today and you're like, oh, I get exactly what they're talking about. The romantic wax on Bedouins. And we have something similar with our romantic views of indigenous North Americans, right? Where they're like these earth-loving environmentalists. And everybody who's been to Cahokia Mounds knows they stripped the earth bare until it killed them off, that kind of thing. But the Negev, the archaeology on the Negev, which I assume still holds to this day, that idea of how much the climate and the dirt and the situation shaped them, and then they had to learn to shape it in that symbiotic relationship. I just thought that was a beautiful analogy of what you see in Eden in kind of a raw, scarce form, scarcity-driven form. Anyways, and how much more they would understand about these things than me, who still carries around an iPhone and et cetera. I don't drive a car, but I do carry an iPhone, so.
Well, and we're doing, we're doing this online on these crazy technologies. Yeah. You can't get away from it.
I love it all and hate it all at the same time. So
that's exactly where I am. Like some days I'm like, man, I would be so much happier if I could just burn it all to the ground.
Technology in there. Oh, you froze.
Well, I don't want to take too much more of your time, so we're brushing up on an hour here. I did want to talk about sex.
Okay. Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me.
I had never thought about the role of monogamy. I mean, like you talk about forced sex and how, calling that sexual immorality, and how do we're going to talk about this kind of thing? But the thing that was interesting to me, I guess, was I had never thought about how hard monogamy is to explain. The question that I had, so first you could sort of talk a little bit about that sort of evolutionarily, but my other question, and this may be a little bit more of a pushback, I guess, is it the case that is monogamy what the Old Testament actually argues for? I'm a monogamous person. As far as I know, I want that to be what the Bible, and I think that is what, ultimately the Christian ethic should be. But how do you deal with the data of there's lots of polygamists for most of the Old Testament, all of the Old Testament? I don't know. Talk a little bit about the possibility of why monogamy is so unique, and then how you derive that from the Old Testament.
Yeah, the monogamy, that was surprising to me as well. And in fact, just the fact that sex differentiation is such an embarrassment to evolutionary biology, I had no idea. I never thought about it a day in my life, and I kept on running into people saying, if evolution had gone correctly, then we wouldn't have sex. We wouldn't have sexual, we wouldn't have males, we wouldn't have females, because then you wouldn't have to have sex and sexual intercourse. And then you wouldn't have to have all the accoutrement that goes with sex that is basically costly and inefficient. And, you know, evolutionary speaking, it's basically the worst thing possible that could happen to the production, the generation of a species. But it's the way it is, right? And so just kind of getting past the embarrassment that sexual difference happens and then sex has to happen for the evolutionary storyline. Monogamy, what was also interesting, and again, we're talking about certain groups. So I tried to stick to hominids, you know, like apes, Homo erectus, Homo naledi, Homo neanderthalis, like tried to stick to the things that we could recognize here. Is it seems to be just true for a lot of mammals that if both the male and the female stick around, I call it come, play, and stay, that they, you know, if they have sex, the especially if the male sticks around, doesn't kill any of the children, which happens with a lot of mammals, doesn't kill any of the children and stays and protects and plays and fosters, then that's kind of the best outcome for that genetic line. And the problem is like, well, but how would any male, even like humans, how would a human know that that's actually the best outcome? And why wouldn't it just be to go with your impulses when you're a 13, 14 year old boy and just kind of have sex with everything that you can have sex with? And then for hominids as well, you know, we talk about rape, but actually not all, or I should say, we think about rape, we think instantly about males raping females, which is typically how it goes. I didn't also realize that that's unique to humans and apes, and particularly humans and hominids, where the males are bigger and stronger than the females, where 99% of species out there, the females are either bigger or they're equally matched, just physically speaking. So there's something about being a hominid that also makes us especially rapey, if I can use the term, where we're more likely to use what they call forced copulation, which is the polite term, what we call rape when it comes to human sexual assault. We're just more likely to do it because of the makeup of our testosterone is a hormone. Our hormonal limbic systems and our size, right? That when you put all that together, so. It's kind of like everything is going against the story of monogamy. Like it doesn't make sense to have sexual differentiation, males and females. It doesn't make sense to have to use sexual intercourse in order to generate new children. It doesn't make sense for the men to stay around. It makes more sense because in most hominids and many mammals, the men can constantly inseminate, where the women can only be inseminated particular periods. So none of it makes sense. And yet against all the biological evidence, it's like, you know, it's kind of like the Sabbath, where Josh Berman points out that there's no, you know, months, years, days are all part of the celestial beings. Like we get all of those directly from nature, the currents of nature. There is no 7-day period in nature that can be discerned, right? It's like it's revealed in creation, but it's not discernible in nature. So in the same way, there is no like monogamous relationship that can be discerned, except for the brute biological reality of a male. It actually is only one male and female in a given time that can mate. So that's kind of interesting. I don't know what to do with it other than just say like the data have some really interesting things going on here. I'm not going to become like an apologist and say, therefore, you know, because I am an Old Testament scholar. And I do say when you look at polygyny in scripture, because I don't think there's any multiple husbands. So it only goes polygyny, polygynous relationships. Just discerning between prescription and description. I mean, I try to show in there, there's all kinds of sex acts that are described, which we just assume are not prescribed. The weird thing is why we would assume polygamy is prescribed. I'd say if you were just to take a biblical theological argument, God doesn't create in creation before things go wrong. He doesn't create a polygynous relationship. Mm-hmm. He creates a monogamous relationship. All of the polygynous relationships discussed in scripture they all have deep problems. So there's no positive description of polygyny in scripture. And in fact, if you take something like David, for example, you could pick any of them, but take David, his polygynous relationships causes children to sexually assault one another and to eventually try to kill him, right? So like, they're telling stories that this is a way you can exist in the world, but it's going to be bad every direction you go, right? So I think there's a constant critique. And when you get to Leviticus 18 and 20, it reduces all relationships down to one possible positive relationship. So it has lots of sexual relationships that you can't have. The only one you can have is with a spouse who's not menstruating at the time, if she's menstruating, right? Which again points to that issue of generation, that they are really worried about generation and propagation beyond generation. You get to the New Testament as well, and anytime Jesus is asked about sex, he doesn't go to Leviticus 18, he doesn't go to Abraham, he goes straight back to Genesis 2, as it was not so from the beginning. And talks about the sexual union of that one man and one woman at the beginning. So I think the whole whole scripture is affirming that monogamous relationship, what we would now call monogamy. But it is by inference and by what I would call that Hebraic style of telling stories, legal reasoning, poetry, and ritual that all reinforce this fact and kind of cut off all other explanations for what they think is good. But again, this is kind of goes back to my, like, if you want a command to tell you whether to do or not to do something, well, scripture's not your place, because a lot of stuff that we believe is true, right, and wise is not commanded. So it's not commanded not to have sex before marriage, but by looking across the text, it's very obvious that they would think it was obviously wrong not to have sex before marriage. It doesn't command you to not genocidally attack your high school, but from looking across scripture, it looks pretty obvious that that would be a forbidden activity, right? For all kinds of reasons. So I think monogamy and polygamy fit into that same rubric of, it's so important that they don't want to mess it up by just giving you a command that you could find some way to weasel around, but they sew it into the creation and then across all the prescriptions of text.
Yeah. And if people are interested in the sort of legal reasoning, again, I hope that you'll listen to our other conversation, but also that you'd buy your other book, The Biblical Philosophy. And do you have one specifically on legal reasoning too? I don't think I ever talked to you about that one. I'm working on one right now on
how to read biblical law. So
yeah. And I mean, another one of those things that just, you talk about the difference between, what is it, like the English statutory law,
right.
and you know, things that just never, like, had never crossed my mind.
Well, me too. I'm usually writing things that blew my mind first, right?
So, yeah. So very helpful framing for, making someone a better reader of the Old Testament. Yeah, I the only other thing I could think of when I was reading your book too, just thinking a little bit about creation and stuff, and I just heard another podcast talking about it, but there's a lot of interesting things for what does it mean to do creation, to be in relation to creation, that's not really the point of this book, but there could be sort of environmental ethics or something a lot of strands that come straight out of this towards what does it mean to be a part of creation rather than just to rule over it or something.
Yeah, I would hope so. And again, that kind of gets at those deeper conflicts that I think arise as you look at the conceptual worlds, that there actually is a more powerful argument for the treatment of animals, what we call ironically the humane treatment of animals, right, even though they're not humans. The care for environment, that's the exciting thing about putting two things that don't seem like they go together in direct conversation, is you get to hear how they excavate the world differently. And I learned so much, and it was fun just writing it. And and I'm no expert on science or Darwinism, so I feel like when people start asking me questions on that, I'm like, I don't know, let me get you a good book on that. I can put these things in the conversation, but I'm no expert. I just read a lot and know how to quote. So
excellent. All right. Well, I really appreciate Drew taking his time to talk with us again, and Grant for your questions. Do you want to say anything else, Grant, before we head out?
No. Just thank you. Thank you for having me on. Thank you for interviewing Dr. Johnson. It's been a lot of fun.
Excellent.
All right. The pleasure is all mine, gentlemen. Thank you, Grant and Chad, for having me on again. I hope to be a super guest.
Yeah.